Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, is it safer in the U.S. now that Saddam Hussein is under arrest in Iraq?
And the greatest senator you may never have heard of announces his retirement, Louisiana's John Breaux.
He's the one everybody trusts. He's the one who can sit down with senior Democrats and senior Republicans and negotiate a deal.
Also, ever been wakened up in the middle of the night by a car alarm? Well, New Yorkers are fed up, and some city councilors are trying to ban the darn things.
My constituents call at 2 in the morning at wit's end because there's a blaring car alarm, sometimes 3 or 4 at once.
These stories and Who Said Scrooge Had to Be a He? Coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Documents discovered with Saddam Hussein at his capture have apparently helped U.S. authorities nab more wanted Iraqi fugitives. NPR's Eric Westervelt spoke with Brigadier General Martin Dempsey. He says the new information has shed new light on who's been paying Iraqi insurgents to attack U.S.-led troops in Iraq.
General Dempsey said that the documents were, quote, in his words, like committee meeting notes, and that it led to specific names of individuals and to actionable intelligence, as the military calls it, that led to some raids on people that were giving money and financial support to these 8 or 10 cells operating independently in the Baghdad area. These are people that have provided money, that have provided ammunition, and have been essentially the checkbook writers for the insurgents. He believes this has been a significant development in trying to uncover just who was behind the financing of these insurgents and these attacks on U.S. forces.
NPR's Eric Westervelt in Baghdad. Federal advisory panels will recommend or reject a new contraception option to the Food and Drug Administration. An issue is whether the morning-after pill should be available to women without a prescription. Dr. Dan Davis has testified that the pill, referred to as Plan B, is safe and effective.
Plan B has a safety profile that includes no deaths, strokes, or thromboembolic events. There's a low potential for misuse and abuse. The safety risks are very limited. We believe that allergy is the only contraindication, which is rarely seen, and there are no reported deaths or hospitalizations.
The panels will vote today whether to recommend that the pill be available at retail outlets like supermarkets and convenience stores. The FDA will also examine whether women will understand how and when to take the pill if they do not have a medical professional to guide them. The New York Times has joined several Connecticut papers and state politicians in calling for the resignation of Republican Governor John Rowland. Heather Claiborne of member station WNPR reports.
After weeks of denials, the governor admitted last Friday that a major state contractor and former members of his administration arranged or paid for renovations to his summer home. In an editorial today, the Times said unless Rowland can put to rest doubts about his honesty, he should turn power over to his lieutenant governor. But both Republican and Democratic legislative leaders are calling for patience. Democratic State Senate President Kevin Sullivan says rank-and-file mumbling about impeachment is premature.
This is not a political moment. This is not a partisan moment. This is truly, truly about the future of the state of Connecticut, the future of public confidence, and some of the gravest things that you can ever be asked to consider as a legislator, let alone as a citizen.
Sullivan says they're waiting to see what comes out of investigations by the U.S. Attorney's Office and State Ethics Commission. For NPR News, I'm Heather Claiborne in Hartford.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 55 points at 10,078. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, a decision is expected today on whether snowmobiles will be allowed in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Room reservations at Yellowstone National Park this winter are down, and the park's concessionaire says it's directly attributable to confusion over whether or not snowmobiles will be allowed to zoom in to Old Faithful. The park's winter season is set to begin Wednesday, and under a new Park Service plan, 950 snowmobiles will be allowed in on a daily basis. That plan stems from a Bush administration reversal of a plan by the Clinton administration to phase snowmobiles out of the parks. A coalition of environmental groups have sued, arguing the Park Service is ignoring its own science by allowing any snowmobiles in the parks, no matter how limited. Gateway communities at the park's entrances are hoping for some final resolution as the confusion has resulted in lost tourism dollars. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News.
The government reports that consumer prices were tame last month. The Labor Department says they dropped 0.2% in November. Prices for clothing, gas, and airline tickets were cheaper. The drop in the consumer price index is the first since April. Excluding food and energy prices, the so-called core rate of inflation also dropped 0.1%. The Commerce Department reports construction on new homes and apartments rose in November. That rate was up 4.5%. The federal agency says this is the fastest building rate reported in nearly 20 years. Analysts say mortgage rates are still low, and that's helping consumers. The National Association of Home Builders reports 30-year fixed mortgages average about 5.88%. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR shop introduces the All Songs Considered gift set, the complete collection of CDs and a CD opener wrapped together in a single package at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Now that Saddam Hussein is in U.S. custody, is the U.S. any safer? In his news conference yesterday, President Bush said the U.S. is a safer place. But in his first major foreign policy speech yesterday, Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean disagreed.
The capture of Saddam is a good thing, which I hope very much will keep our soldiers in Iraq and around the world safer. But the capture of Saddam has not made America safer.
Well, rival presidential candidate Senator Joseph Lieberman then attacked Dean.
Howard Dean said in a speech he gave on foreign policy that the capture of Saddam Hussein did not make America safer. Now, and with all respect, I mean, by saying that, I think he's himself climbed into what I might call a spider hole of denial.
Well, former Army Colonel Kenneth Allard is a military analyst for MSNBC and a professor at Georgetown University. Colonel Allard now joins us. Welcome, Colonel.
Good morning.
Colonel, President Bush said again yesterday in his press conference what he said so many times, that the driving force of his entire presidency, more than anything else, is his vow to protect Americans and American security. Now that the dust has settled somewhat, are we safer as a result of Saddam Hussein being in custody?
Well, only if you take the most extraordinarily broad view of it. Is it something which impacts the daily life of most Americans? I would simply say that it's a lot like playing the stock market, and you ask yourself, am I better or worse off depending on what happened today on the market? Well, the answer to that really depends on whether or not you've had any money at risk. There is no question about the fact that the apprehension of Saddam is a great step forward in Iraq, but it really is just a minor victory in the war on terrorism, which is a much larger proposition.
So do you agree with Howard Dean?
Not really, simply because of the fact that, you know, you make progress in this way by fits and starts, and you don't want to get too terribly hysterical every time we have reverses. You don't want to get too overly optimistic when we have great successes. The thing that really matters is how much progress you make on this thing every single day, and you simply cannot make that kind of progress by trying to shore up American defenses here at home. It requires both the offense and the defense.
Colonel, you're not a political analyst. You don't make any claim to be. But let me ask you to put on that hat for just a second. What do you make of the other Democrats, particularly Kerry and Lieberman and Gephardt to an extent, going after Dean for what he said?
Well, look, the other day it was a terrible day if you were Saddam Hussein, but it was conceivably even worse if you were Howard Dean, because any time the Bush administration has a success, as it did, it redounds to his benefit. And you simply see the other Democratic candidates trying to distance themselves from Howard Dean. That's understandable, but again, it is not something which is terribly related to the reality of American homeland security, which is that what we do in Iraq affects it very substantially, but it does so only on a marginal basis, and it is what you do every single day, not how good you did yesterday.
Yeah, it will be a highly publicized trial, though, a New York Times editorial today said, good as it may be to have this evil man in custody, when human rights groups were criticizing him even 20 years ago, he was then an American client to an extent, because, of course, he'd gone to war with Iran. Could Saddam reveal in a trial, Colonel, do you think, uncomfortable information about his relationship with the U.S. government at that time and what the U.S. government may have given to him, even along the lines of chemical and biological information or weapons themselves?
I think that Saddam Hussein has a great many potentially embarrassing things to say about a great many governments, not merely about the American assistance he may have received, but also in much more recently and much more significantly, the amount of assistance that he has received from, let us say, the French and the German governments as they tried to ingratiate themselves with him. And I think that he'll have an awful lot of tales to tell out of school. Now, the thing that is going to be interesting, again, is the extent to which he is given this as a platform and the extent to which he is allowed to deviate from the central issue which is there. And the central issue which is there is potentially genocide, is certainly mass murder, and is frankly everything that he did that we associate with the worst regimes in most recent history.
Colonel, would you expect that Saddam Hussein is headed for execution?
Absolutely. I would certainly hope so, simply because of the fact that if you are going to allow this guy, this mass murderer, this advocate of genocide, this advocate of weapons of mass destruction, which he used against his own people, if you allow him to skate, I really worry about the standards for international justice that you're setting for the future. It would be a very, very dangerous and unhealthy precedent.
Former Army Colonel Kenneth Allard is a military analyst for MSNBC and a professor at Georgetown University. Colonel Allard, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Louisiana Senator John Breaux is retiring. The Democrat announced yesterday that he will not seek another term, signaling the end of a 30-year career and sounding another death knell for his specialty, nonpartisan politics. Breaux also becomes one of five Southern Democratic senators to announce retirement. Not good news for the party. Larry Sabato is a political scientist at the University of Virginia. And Larry, Senator Breaux, he's really known for crossing the aisle, as they say.
John Breaux is, without any question, one of the most constructive members of the U.S. Senate. Here is a senior individual who is well-respected within his own party caucus, and yet is also able to reach his hand across the aisle and generate compromise in a Senate that has been terribly polarized for years.
Give us a sense of how polarized. I mean, you know, some of the numbers are alarming. I was reading that 30 years ago, party members would cross party lines maybe two-thirds of the time. And now, how many are there who actually do that?
Just a handful do it. I'd have to say, though, it's important to note that the polarization comes and goes. At the turn of the century, the early 1900s, the Senate was actually even more polarized than the current Senate. Mm-hmm. So these things come and go. But Breaux has served so constructively because he's the one everybody trusts. He's the one who can sit down with senior Democrats and senior Republicans and negotiate a deal, bring it together, get legislation passed, legislation that doesn't please everybody in every respect. But sometimes it's better to have a piece of the pie than nothing at all.
Can you tick off some of the legislation that he may have had a hand in shaping?
I would say quite literally, in the last couple of Congresses, he has played a role, and sometimes the central role, in just about every major piece of legislation. Look at Medicare. I don't think there would have been any chance of Medicare happening had he not helped to bridge the gap between the two parties. Now, look, you may not like the Medicare bill, but John Breaux got it done. And in the end, legislatures, Congresses, Senates are judged by what they are able to accomplish.
We understand that he helped broker the Bush education bill, getting more federal money in it. He was part of a group that helped broker the tax cut by forcing the president to accept billions less in the package. And he also co-founded with Olympia Snow of Maine the Senate Centrist Coalition, which sounds like a very small group of people.
It is increasingly small. And look, the examples you just gave, Robin, are very, very important. I think you could argue that the ones you mentioned were, again, whether you like them or dislike them, the most important accomplishments of the first session of this particular Congress.
And what does this do? I mean, obviously, this hurts the world of compromise. But how does it also hurt the Democrats? Because there's a chance that they might not keep his seat.
John Breaux, unfortunately for the Democrats, is part of a terrible pattern for 2004. There are now five open seats currently held by Democrats, all in the South, with the Republicans breathing down the necks of the Democrats in all five. Now, I don't think, personally, that the Republicans will carry all five. Would I bet today they would get at least three? I would. It's possible they'll get four. But here's the interesting thing. Breaux is so respected and popular in Louisiana. That's the Democrats' best shot to hang on to a seat in the South in 2004.
Larry Sabatow, political scientist at the University of Virginia. Well, staying with Southern politics, in 1948, it would have been a career-ending scandal. At that time, Democratic Senator Strom Thurmond ran for president on a states' right platform that included a plank standing for the segregation of the races and the racial integrity of each race. If Essie Mae Washington Williams had come forward then to say she was the product of an affair between a 22-year-old Thurmond and his family's 16-year-old black maid, South Carolina's political history would have been very different. But Thurmond died this summer at the age of 100, and times have changed. Essie Mae, now 78, has stepped forward to make public a relationship that she and her father kept private. The Thurmond family confirms her claim, and much of the South has yawned. Skylar Croft is a reporter for the Charleston Post-Courier. He joins us now from Charleston, South Carolina. Skylar, hello.
Hello.
Well, what's the reaction of people in South Carolina to this news?
It's really not as shocking as I thought it would be. Everyone kind of knew the story in it way back when, so it really has not turned as many heads as I thought.
How are people in South Carolina dealing with the hypocrisy of a lot of this?
Well, a lot of people see Thurmond as greatly changing with the winds beginning back in the 1970s and 80s when he did start introducing blacks on his staff and voting for the Martin Luther King holiday and endorsing Clarence Thomas and those sort of things. So he was not the screaming kind of George Wallace segregationist. He was a little bit different about that.
Yeah. I mean, tell us more about that. Is there a little bit of the sort of, I mean, remember when Trent Lott famously made a comment just last year about Strom Thurmond? If he'd become president, the country would be a better place, and everybody interpreted that to mean that, you know, segregation would have been the better way to go. And we heard then that, you know, outsiders just didn't understand the South. Is there a sense of that now, that none of us can really understand the South and the changes it's had to go through?
Well, I think that Thurmond, too, it's kind of in his old age became a different person, and there was a degree of respect from white and black that came with that when he became such a grandfatherly senator. He was known for the best constituent service in the country, black or white, no matter what the problem was. And I think that pretty much took over for the image of the man. A lot of that was, you know, the segregationist stuff for a lot of people was known as the before time.
So this isn't going to alter the way Strom Thurmond is remembered.
You know, there's two schools of thought. There's one that, you know, that was old Strom and he lived to be 100. And there's the funny way of looking at that as this old grandfatherly figure. And then there's another way that it just might bring to grips in the South the common practice of a whites in powers having a child with their black servants. And we talked to some political scientists about that who thought that, you know, this would bring more of that out. But the problem with that also is that, you know, Thurmond was 100 and was from a different age and a different time. And then you just got to wonder how much of that is still left.
Yeah. He's practically from Jefferson's time.
Yeah, exactly. There were comparisons to the Sally Hemings incident with Thurmond.
Right. Well, Skylar, thank you so much.
All right. Good day.
Skylar Croft is a reporter for the Charleston Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina.
Just ahead, new ways of treating epilepsy.
And city councils in New York say they're getting closer to a ban on car alarms.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Nearly 3 million Americans have epilepsy, a disorder characterized by seizures in the brain. Epilepsy has been treated in a number of ways, everything from a strict high-fat diet to a wide range of increasingly sophisticated drugs. And now, brain surgery is an early option for people with epilepsy. Here and Now's Gail Harris spoke with Help columnist Judy Foreman about the decision to go under the knife to treat epilepsy.
There's a very interesting study going on now across the country on the theory that intervening earlier in the course of epilepsy with this brain surgery may actually spare people 20 or 30 years of unpleasantness and distress from epilepsy without treating it with anything except drugs. The idea is to take out a small part of the brain, maybe the size of an ice cube, and that would be the place where the seizures actually start. And in a study in Canada, the people who had that operation were much more likely to be seizure-free than the people who only got drugs. So the idea now in this country is to do this big national study to see if it works, if people would be benefited by having the surgery earlier rather than later in their disease.
And how do you find out which people it will be helpful for? Do you start with drugs, and then if that doesn't work, you move to something like brain surgery,
or can you
determine that earlier?
I think that's right. And also people who look like their disease is getting worse, you know, quickly. But anyone with epilepsy should obviously talk to their doctor because they may be a candidate for this and it could save them 10 or 20 years of unpleasantness.
You also write about something called a hemispherectomy,
Yes. Which
is removing half the brain. I mean, that sounds
yes.
so incredible. Is that really viable?
Yes, it's been done for years and years. It is literally taking out half the brain, one hemisphere. But the reason for this new study, which takes out a much smaller part of the brain, is because everybody realizes taking out half the brain is a very radical thing to do. But obviously, if you can take out a smaller piece of tissue, that would be much better.
Well, how well can you function with only half your brain?
Amazingly well. I mean, kids can walk. I mean, you are somewhat paralyzed on the side opposite to the side they take out, but kids learn to walk again and talk again. I mean, they're not quite normal, but they do reasonably well.
All right, so that's brain surgery, that's drugs. What are some of the other treatments available?
There's actually a lot going on, and there was a conference just last week in Boston for the American Epilepsy Society. One of the things that's not yet on the market, but it's a product called NeuroPace that would actually be an implant in the brain. They would put electrodes on the surface of the brain, and the idea is that these electrodes would pick up the first electrical signals of a seizure about to start and then fire off some electricity and stop the seizure before it starts. And the other thing that is available is called vagus nerve stimulation. They basically put a pacemaker, kind of like the size of a hockey puck, under the skin in your chest and thread a wire up your neck to the vagus nerve. And the machine fires like every few minutes, and that stimulates the vagus nerve to send a message to the brain, which stops seizures.
And what about the role of diet?
That's actually really important in this. There's a kind of diet called the ketogenic diet, K-E-T-O-G-E-N-I-C. And that's basically a very low carbohydrate, very fat, high fat diet. And they put kids on this diet, and it really helps their epilepsy a lot. So that is something for people with epilepsy to consider. You know, it's been shown in kids in a very preliminary study, but a very high fat, low carb diet may help prevent some seizures.
Here and Now's health columnist Judy Foreman speaking with Gail Harris. To read Judy's latest column, go to our website, here-now.org.
Well, is there anyone who's ever spent any time sleeping in an American city who hasn't experienced that bucket of cold water in the face in the middle of the night that is the car alarm? Well, New Yorkers have pretty much had it. And now a proposal will be heard next month to ban the sale and installation of car alarms. City Council members from Manhattan and Queens are behind the idea. Eva Moskowitz is one of them. Eva, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Eva, don't you want people to keep their cars from getting stolen?
The car alarms have not had any deterrent effect on crime. Uh-huh. What they've done is they've kept New Yorkers from sleeping. I get more complaints on car alarms than probably any other type of complaint. My constituents call at 2 in the morning at wit's end because there's a blaring car alarm, sometimes three or four at once, and I see no reason because car alarms are not having any kind of deterrent effect.
Well, how do you know that?
Well, we've actually asked, we've taken extensive testimony from the police department, and, you know, some people say, you know, they wish the car was stolen because then it would stop making the noise, but it doesn't seem to happen.
I see.
Instead, New Yorkers are simply deprived of peace of mind.
Do you really think it's possible, though, to ban a product like that? I mean, you must be getting some pushback from people who make car alarms.
Well, of course, I think I'm public enemy number one in the car alarm industry magazine.
Uh-huh.
But we actually do have jurisdiction. What we don't have jurisdiction over is the installation by the manufacturer. In other words, if in Detroit it comes with the car, we in New York City can't obviously legislate that kind of thing. But what we can do is we can say that if they're installed by the dealer or anyone else, and most car alarms are actually installed by the dealer or a person takes the car to a shop and gets an audible car alarm. People can have silent car alarms, but they can't have audible car alarms.
Silent car alarms?
Right. In other words, this is a system where they're wired to a police station, but they notify the police, but they don't make noise.
Eva, what do you think are the realistic chances and when of audible car alarms being banned in New York City?
I think very soon. I mean, New Yorkers have had it. They are at their wits' end. So we're going to have a hearing, a second hearing, in about a month after the new year. And I suspect that New York, as it often does, will lead the way in ensuring that residents have peace of mind.
Eva Moskowitz is a city councilor from Manhattan. Her proposal to ban car alarms in New York City will get a hearing next month. Eva, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the 100th anniversary of the first flight, the triumph and trials of the Wright brothers.
And gourmet food online. You won't believe how much of it there is for the holidays.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the debate over making the morning after contraceptive pill available in drugstores.
The whole idea here is the earlier that the woman takes the medication, the more effective it is. And so this medication needs to be available over the counter.
And move over Tenors and Stooges, we have the three Scrooges, each a Scrooge in his or her own right.
Why, if I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips would be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart, he would.
Wow. These stories coming up here and now.
Ouch.
I'm Dolores Handy. With Saddam Hussein now in U.S. custody, a key question for many Americans is when will the troops come home? The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, visited U.S. troops in Baghdad today and said an end date for U.S. occupation of Iraq depends on how fast Iraqis establish stability and their own army. That, he says, will likely take a couple of years. U.S. intelligence agencies are now turning their efforts toward capturing the remaining key figures of Saddam Hussein's regime. Intelligence stemming from his capture led to the arrest of some of his supporters who provided money to insurgents running guerrilla operations attacking U.S. forces in Iraq. Officials say the interrogation effort has yielded no evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction or ties to the al-Qaeda terror network. Former Secretary of State James Baker is reporting some progress in his mission to get other countries to help reduce Iraq's debt. Baker, who was dispatched to Europe by President Bush, says French officials agreed today to work toward lowering billions of dollars in Iraqi debt next year. The Food and Drug Administration is considering the question of whether the emergency contraceptive Depo-Provera, often referred to as the morning-after pill, should be available without a prescription. Supporters say the move would prevent unplanned pregnancies and abortions. A bill President Bush signed into law today is designed to can spam. The legislation outlaws some of the techniques used by emailers who send tens of millions of unwanted messages each day. President Bush signed six other bills today, including one to help the poor buy their first homes and another to give flight attendants self-defense training. New evidence today that inflation is not a problem as the economy shifts into higher gear. The Labor Department reports that consumer prices dropped for the first time since April, pulled down by cheaper gas, clothes, and airfares. Meantime, the Federal Reserve reports industrial production increased 0.9% last month. That is the strongest performance since October of 1999. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow is up 54 points at 10,077. The Nasdaq is down 11 points at 1906. And the S&P 500 is up 2 points at 1070. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Should the morning after pill that prevents 90% of pregnancies if taken within 72 hours of intercourse become as available as aspirin? That's the question before the Federal Drug Administration today. Some anti-abortion groups oppose the pill, but its advocates say it will prevent abortions by preventing unwanted pregnancies. Joining us first is Dr. Thomas Purdon of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which supports making the so-called Plan B pill more accessible. He joins us from Arizona. Welcome, Dr. Purdon.
Hello, Bill.
Doctor, what is the pill made of, and how does it work?
Well, the so-called morning after pill really is nothing more than the same ingredients that are in many oral contraceptive medications. And the idea has been around for a long time. The situation now is the fact that we really need to get broader availability and acceptance of this technique, and several companies have specifically manufactured small quantities of these medications to use as the so-called emergency contraceptive or morning after pill.
How does it terminate a pregnancy?
Well, first of all, let's clarify something. The pill does not terminate an existing pregnancy.
Okay.
If pregnancy is defined by an implantation in the lining of the uterus, these hormone pills will not interfere with an already existing pregnancy. These are higher dose pills taken for a very short time, 2 in the morning, 2 in the evening, and they work in a variety of ways to prevent the pregnancy from starting in the first place.
Uh-huh.
There are some 2 million unplanned, unintended pregnancies in the United States every year, and roughly half of those end up in abortion. And if we can get this method out to the public in general, we feel we are preventing a lot of those women from having to face the idea of abortion.
Well, doctor, how safe is it?
That's a very important question, and I'm happy to be able to say that the pill is very, very safe. That's been studied for so many years. That is the regular oral contraceptive medications. And taken in a very short time like this, the pill is very, very safe. And I think it's important also for your audience to understand that we are not talking about any compounds such as the abortifacient pill or the RU486 pill. That's an entirely different compound.
Doctor, what do you think the chances are that it will become as available as it already is in Europe, for example?
Well, I think it's pretty good, because I do believe that the majority of the people in the government agencies appreciate the fact that we have a tremendous problem with unintended pregnancy. I mean, the whole idea here is the earlier that the woman takes the medication, the more effective it is. And so this medication needs to be available over the counter, and I think the agency will understand this.
And there's no concern in your mind about people who took it repeatedly, too often?
No, I don't think so. Now, there really aren't any good studies on this, but our experience thus far has indicated that people do not use this as routine contraception or birth control. They are so stressed when they do go through this event that it seems to make them more willing to accept an appropriate method of ongoing birth control.
But, doctor, wouldn't you be concerned? Again, I'm thinking of, say, you know, someone young, a college student, for example. Couldn't it get to be habitual?
I really don't think so. That would probably become an economically driven barrier. In other words, to buy the oral contraceptive medication in the emergency contraceptive package would probably cost $30 to $40 on each instance. And those people are smart enough to figure out that they can get regular oral contraception for more like $20 a month. And so they wouldn't likely keep doing that, I do not believe.
Mm. Dr. Thomas Purdon is an Arizona physician and a member of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Purdon, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, now we turn to Wendy Wright, policy director at Concerned Women for America. She's testifying today before the FDA panel against the Plan B pill, and she joins us from Washington. Wendy, hello.
Hello.
Tell us why you are opposed to this morning after pill.
Well, it carries very serious medical risk to women. The studies that have been done on it don't include information on what the long-term effects are in women. In fact, it's not even been tracked. And there's been no studies on what happens if women use it multiple times. And we do know that women do use it multiple times, as the experience has shown in other countries. One of the arguments of the proponents is this could decrease the number of abortions. In fact, that has not happened in areas where there has been easy access to the morning after pill. In Scotland, where it's been easily accessible for years, they've actually seen an increase in the number of abortions.
But wouldn't this Plan B morning after pill automatically lessen the number of abortions because it would prevent unwanted pregnancies?
By making the morning after pill easily accessible, what ends up happening is people do engage in unprotected sex, in more risky forms of sex that they would not have otherwise. And so, for example, in Scotland, the morning after pill prescriptions increased by 300%. And yet, in that same time period, they did see an increase in abortions as well. The proponents of the Plan B have not been forthright. They have not been honest in the information either that they've given the FDA panel or to the public. In fact, just last year, the Plan B promoters were found guilty by the FDA for false advertising. In fact, the letter states the ads are false, lacking in fair balance, otherwise misleading. They fail to convey important limitations on use, minimize important information about risks associated with the use. As a result, the ads raise significant public health and safety concerns.
Wendy, isn't there something to be said for preventing pregnancy in cases where there are contraceptive failures, where there are rapes, other situations where a pregnancy would not only be undesirable but horrific?
What we're often told is that we ought to make something easily accessible for the hard cases. But by making it easily accessible, it's not just going to be those hard cases of rape in which there will be medical intervention. What will end up happening is there will be liberal and frequent use of the morning after pill, not in the hard cases, but more likely in cases where, in fact, say, minors are being abused by adult men. You may end up having adult men slipping this to young girls or even to adult women without their knowledge or their consent, women who want to be pregnant.
But Wendy, we understand that that scenario that you paint could probably not happen because the pill has to be taken in a very regimented way, 2 a.m. and 2 p.m.
For those who are simply intending to make sure a woman doesn't get pregnant, they may not be as concerned about both doses getting administered. They'll give one hoping that it would end the pregnancy. And I say end the pregnancy because in order for something to implant, something must exist. And what exists is a newly formed embryo that has 46 chromosomes, has all the DNA that proves this is a human being. And as most people do believe, based on the biological scientific facts, life does begin at fertilization. So Plan B operates by inhibiting implantation, thereby causing an abortion.
Wendy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wendy Wright, Policy Director at Concerned Women for America. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C., where she is testifying today before the FDA.
Still to come, bah humbug, three Scrooges say. We speak to two men and one woman playing the part.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Was the maker of the greatest violins of all time, Antonio Stradivari, really all he was cracked up to be? Or was he just in the right place at the right time? And I mean, of course, the time known as the Maunder Minimum. Well, before we explore these questions and explain about that Maunder Minimum thing, let's hear first just a little of a Stradivarius. A sound, it's been said, that moves like candlelight. Perfect timbre, a kind of mystic tremble that some, including violinist Isaac Stern, believe resulted from a long-lost varnish. But now there's a new theory, and it has nothing to do with adding anything to the wood. Joining us on the line now is Dr. Henry Grassino Mayer from the Department of Geology at the University of Tennessee. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, Doctor, as I said, this all seems to have something to do with something called the Maunder Minimum. Can you explain?
Yes, it does. The Maunder Minimum was the high point of the Little Ice Age. It lasted from about 1645 to about 1720 or so.
Huh. What's that got to do with wood and trees?
Turns out that the trees that were used by Antonio Stradivari grew during the Little Ice Age and specifically during the Maunder Minimum.
And what does that do to the wood that ended up in the Stradivarius?
Exactly. Well, we believe that the trees that grew during the Maunder Minimum were very slow-growing trees. And this would result in violins with wood that with very unique physical properties and very unique tonal qualities.
Uh-huh. And because they grow more slowly, they're more dense?
Exactly.
I see. And
exactly.
Uh-huh. Doctor, before I ask you just a couple more questions, let's hear just a little bit more of a Stradivarius. So, Doctor, lovely as that sound is, does Antonio Stradivari get a little more credit than maybe he's due? Because, after all, he was just using the wood that was there for the cutting?
He was definitely using wood that has not been produced since. But at the same time, let's not discredit Antonio Stradivari. I think, and many others think, that one of the secret ingredients was simply the gray matter between his ears. He was a very talented, very, very talented violin maker. And the fact that he had, in our opinion, unique wood to work with makes his instruments that much more prized.
I think you've come up with something awfully interesting, Doctor.
Thank you.
Is anybody challenging your theory, or where
of
does
course.
It... Of course. Oh, I see.
Of course.
It's not the
course.
Orthodoxy just yet, or maybe ever, huh?
No. And I think the mark of good science is not only for the work that's done, but also for the controversy and more questions that science raises.
Doctor, just to finish up then, maybe a little bit of scientific resistance, but what about from lovers of the Stradivarius? Do they for any reason have a problem with your theory?
Yes, because there's a certain amount of romanticism involved with Stradivari violins, and some will just want to believe that it was a secret varnish or that it was a secret ingredient or that he seasoned it just in a different way or whatever, a secret technique that's gone undocumented. And I'm not out to convince those people otherwise. There will always be romanticism involved with Stradivari instruments.
Some don't really want it explained, but maybe Dr. Henry Grassino Mayer has explained it. Doctor, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Henry Grassino Mayer joined us on the line from the University of Tennessee with The Secret of the Stradivarius.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's a play that is the theatrical equivalent of the ballet's Nutcracker, a holiday season staple. It's A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens' classic tale of the miser Ebenezer Scrooge and his reformation after a ghostly intervention by his deceased friend Jacob Marley.
You will be haunted by three spirits.
Three spirits?
Is that the chance and hope you mentioned? It is. Well, in that case, I think I'd rather not.
Scrooge and Marley is played by George C. Scott and Frank Finley. Scrooge has also been played by Patrick Stewart, Alastair Sim, and Mr. Magoo, and by Stacey Keach, Anna Scuria, and David Coffey. All three now join us on the line. Stacey Keach is playing Ebenezer in Boston in a production sponsored by Trinity Repertory Theater. Welcome, Stacey.
Bah humbug.
And David Coffey has played Ebenezer for 13 years. He's now appearing at the North Shore Music Theater in Beverly, Massachusetts. David, you got to give us your humbug.
Humbug.
Oh, boy. On the line from Providence, Rhode Island, a female Scrooge, Annie Scuria. She's in another Trinity Rep Theater production. Hi, Annie.
Bah humbug.
Well, you know, Annie, let's start with you. I bet the guys are also wondering, is there anything we should know about this Scrooge, that it's played by a woman?
Well, this is actually my third attempt at this role. I did it in here at Trinity in 96 and 97. And it's such a gigantic, huge journey that it really is genderless to a great degree, going from such a desiccated human spirit to such a fully alive and joyous one.
Can you just give us a couple of lines from your Scrooge?
Oh, sure. How can I not be angry, Fred, when I live in such a world of fools as this? What is Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills with no money? A time for finding yourself a year older and not an hour richer? Why, if I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips would be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart, he would.
Uncle! That's the next line. I haven't
there
had a script.
There you go. That was
right
very good.
Of me. Stacy, your thoughts on not only Annie Scrooge, but also, I mean, you all have to make your Scrooges stand out. So obviously she does automatically. She's a female. What do you do?
Well, I don't know. It's like a memory play in a sense, and I think that it's a very painful journey. At least I'm finding it to be a very painful one.
Really?
You have to face the tragedies of one's life, and that I think that's what finally allows Scrooge to emerge as a butterfly at the end.
Right. When Annie Scrooge left off, Scrooge, was talking to his nephew about Christmas and, you know, getting across that message of Scrooge, that bah humbug to Christmas. Can you pick up there, Stacy, in this discussion with the nephew?
And what happens is these two solicitors come in and they ask him for some money to help the poor. And they said, what can we ask you to give? And he says, nothing. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. My taxes support the establishments I've mentioned, and they cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there.
Well, many can't go there, and many would rather die.
If they would rather die, they'd better do it and decrease the surplus population.
Stacy Keach as Scrooge. David Coffey is sitting here in the studio with me, Stacy, and kind of nodding his head and going, not bad. David, as you listen to Stacy Keach and to Annie Scurria before him, there are so many. I mean, it just points out how many people do Scrooge. How do you do it and stand out? Or do you not try to stand out? Do you try to?
You don't try to stand out.
No.
You just try to. You play the role.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You do what work there is. The thing is, the audience first sees you and hears you as what he has become, and what happens during the course of the play is you have to peel back the layers to see how he got to be that person.
Yeah.
And then comes the great change at the end, and we. It's such a joyous thing. And what makes it special is the audience takes that journey with him.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well said, Dave.
Can you share a little of Scrooge after the Reformation?
Oh, yes. Let's see here. When he wakes up, he says, the bed curtains, they're not torn down. They're here, rings and all. The teaspoon, the sugar tongs are here. I am here. The shadows of the things that might have been may be dispelled. No, they will be. I know they will.
Oh.
No.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
That was so much fun.
That was great.
We're each getting ideas from the other.
Well, I can't wait to see everybody else's.
Yeah.
But do you go and observe other people's Scrooges?
A very good friend of mine, a couple of years ago, made a video Christmas card of all the Scrooges that have been filmed and put them all together, including Michael Caine and the Muppets. And I had no idea at that time that I was going to actually be playing the role one day. But, I pulled it out after I found out I was going to come and do it and use that sort of as, you know, some research material just to find out what other people have done.
Annie, you're the only female Scrooge I've ever heard of, but are there other offbeat Scrooges?
Well, you know, it's not so much that it's offbeat. What David was saying is so true. You play yourself, and it is a genderless role in a way, as I said before. But also, as a woman, I look at the Cratchit family and see the family I never had and the children I never had. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it is a different journey for a woman than for a man. But it's certainly not a gimmick. I think in some ways being a woman helps me to be emotionally able to take the audience on this incredible roller coaster journey.
Annie, how do they handle in your adaptation the young Scrooge and Belle scene?
What we do is
what's that again? Remind us.
In Christmas Past, we see there's young Scrooge, mm-hmm. you know, and he
has a betrothal with Belle, and then there's a rejection scene, which is a very major turning point in his life. And I was just anxious how they handled that in that situation.
We make it Will.
Those characters switch
genders, yes.
Genders for that performance.
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
All the young Scrooges are women, like, you know, young women.
Exactly.
And so that when you go back to the school, when she's left at the, when Ebenezer is left at the school, it's a little girl that's left.
Wow, and people don't, I mean, you are tampering here with a time-honored holiday tradition. People don't mind that.
Well, no, I don't think people mind that.
Well, I think that, you know, it's interesting. The first time we did it in 96, there was a hue and cry, apparently, on the internet of all kinds of Dickens aficionados and intelligentsia saying, this is blasphemy. Dickens would never want this and put up with it. And then what happens is that the audience may be a little skeptical at first, but they're completely won over by the end.
Well, Stacey Keach, who is the greatest Scrooge of all time, in your opinion?
Well, I think that's impossible to say. I think every single Scrooge has wonderful qualities that are totally unique to that particular actor playing it. If I were to have to make a choice, I would have to say probably in my mind it would be the first Scrooge that I encountered when I was a kid, which was Frederick March.
Mm. And David, you have been doing your Scrooge for 13 years.
Oh, that's so great.
Well, I've done 12 years here. This is my 12th year at the North Shore Theater, and then I did two tours back in the 80s. And then I said the first time I did, I guess, was in high school, so I've been doing it a long time.
Don't you ever get tired of it? How do you?
Well, no, of course not. How can you?
Oh, it's such a fabulous role.
That's the thing. Those roles are few and far between when you get to have such a change and such a journey and
that's
all.
That's right.
I want to wish you all well with your performances this holiday season.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And perhaps, Stacey, you can sign off in a way that Scrooge would. Is there something particular from the play that would be appropriate?
I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. Mm.
David is nodding, and I have a feeling that Annie is too.
Yes.
Well, God bless us, everyone.
God bless
thank
us everyone.
You so much.
You'd make
much.
A
that
lovely Tiny Tim, Robin.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
David Coffey, now appearing at the North Shore Music Theater in Beverly, Massachusetts. Stacey Keach, who is playing Ebenezer in Boston in a production sponsored by Trinity Repertory Theater. And Anna Scuria from the Trinity Rep Theater production in Providence, Rhode Island, Scrooges All.
Mr. Scrooge, you'll be very merry and happy this day, I have no doubt.
No doubt.
Cheers.
God bless us, everyone. Life is full of sweet surprises. Every day's a gift. The sun comes up and I can...
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
We had to hear from the Muppets. I'm Robin Young.
Had to happen. I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Look into the eyes of love and know that I belong. Bless us all who gather here. The loving family I hold.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
It's the 100th anniversary of the first flight. We'll explore the triumphs and many trials of the Wright brothers.
And 'tis the season to eat. We offer gourmet food online.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.